Support for WPR comes from Stoughton Health, an independent community healthcare organization, treating acute mental health disorders in adults age 55 and over, accepting many insurance plans. StoughtonHealth.com.
Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. With summer camps for pre-K through high school, offering skills in sports, music, and more. luther.edu/summer-camps.
From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I think Philip Dick is the most important figure in science fiction, even more so perhaps than E.G. Wells.
Philip K. Dick is an extremely important figure in the genre of science fiction because of the darker view that he took of the possible effects of technological change.
Philip K. Dickian, I would define that as surrealist science fiction.
A work that is deeply paranoid, deeply intelligent, deeply scared, and deeply funny.
That moment when all of the new technologies combine together to create a sense that reality is not the same as it was before, that it's gone surrealistic. Things have just gone crazy.
He seems like someone trying desperately to make sense of a world that in its sum total makes no sense. And I think the world kind of feels like that most times.
Philip Dick's work still captures our imagination because, in a way, it's no longer imagination. It's reality.
He changed Hollywood. He changed the way we think about America and about modern technology.
He's really one of the best descriptors of our entire culture.
That's a montage of clips from an episode of the Science Channel television series Prophets of Science Fiction. Philip K. Dick was indeed a prophet. His novels introduced the concept of virtual reality, which of course is now an actual reality. And in books like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, he blurred the boundaries between man and machine, anticipating the technological breakthroughs we see every day in robotics. Philip K. Dick died more than 30 years ago, on March 2, 1982. He was disconnected from life support and died days after suffering two strokes. He was 53. Today, we pay homage to Philip K. Dick's life and legacy. We'll find out how Dick's imagination has influenced the movies. Jonathan Lethem talks about Dick's novels and the strange visionary experiences he obsessed over during the last 8 years of his life. Also, his former wife, Anne Dick, shares her memories of their marriage. But we start by exploring one of the central questions that runs throughout Dick's novels and short stories. What is reality? Umberto Rossi is a literary critic living in Rome. He's the author of The Twisted Worlds of Philip K. Dick, a reading of 20 ontologically uncertain novels. Umberto Rossi talked with Anne Strangechamps.
He's regarded as a science fiction writer, and you say you feel a special kind of kinship with him as an Italian, as though he could be describing life in Italy. Is there something sort of science fictional about living in Italy, aside from Berlusconi?
Unfortunately, I'll have to deal with that. He's no more the prime minister at the moment, as you probably know. But anyway, what happens is this, is in one of his novels, The Simulacra, there is also another one, The Penultimate Truth, Dick imagines a future America where the president of the United States is actually an android, which is just switched on before the TV programs start, talks to the American people, and then when the TV camera is switched off, and used only as a stage prop, what can I say, as a dummy, a talking dummy. Mm-hmm. Well, we had the feeling that for 11 years, Italy was ruled by something like that. I mean, when Berlusconi was the prime minister, we felt that basically the political program of his party was the screenplay for a reality show. And that's what is Dickian and also Italian, but I think also American. And probably something that is worldwide today. The mixing of media reality and daily life and politics and the way of life, you know, this is something that you find in his novel that talks to everyone, wherever he lives.
And part of what you're describing is this kind of fundamental uncertainty about what's real and what's not real. Dick himself, there's this famous thing he said once. He was defining reality, and he said, "It's reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away," which at first glance would seem obvious. Of course, reality doesn't go away, but I think it's a subtler comment.
What I find fascinating in that famous quotation of Dick is that the basic idea is that reality is not something that manifests itself clearly. It's something that doesn't want to go away. What's the meaning of this? The meaning is that we have a map, a mental map of reality in our head. And sometimes we superimpose the map that we have in our head, the image of reality that we have in our head, that can be wrong sometimes. We superimpose it on reality. So sometimes we don't really access reality directly. We have our desires, fears, expectations, paranoias, whatever, that act like a sort of filter between us and reality, create a sort of virtual reality that happens for everybody. Well, in a media-saturated society like ours, this is even stronger. We know much, not because we have been there and seen that. We know a lot because we have seen it on TV, on the internet, on some website, read it on the Wikipedia. And well, when things do not fit our mental map, mental image, maybe we have touched reality because it doesn't fit our little mental play, our little mental theater. Okay, that's, I think, what an interpretation can be of that famous statement by Dick.
So is this feeling what you mean when you say that a theme running through all of Dick's work is something called ontological uncertainty?
Well, yes, yes, definitely. Basically, is what I have used as a unifying thread in my book, reading 20 novels and several short stories that Dick wrote. What does ontological mean? It's something that's got to do with reality and being. It's a philosophical term, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it's a term that Dick often used, especially in the second part of his career, in the 70s and the early 80s. Ontology has to do with what being really is. And obviously, when we talk about reality, faked reality, virtual reality, and whatever, is this the reality or just an image of it, an image that can be faked, can be altered, can be wrong, and whatever? Well, these are ontological issues. And ontological uncertainty, because basically what you feel, what you find yourself into when you read a novel or a short story by Philip K. Dick, it's not that you find that there is another reality behind this, and that is the truth. This is The Matrix, the mm-hmm. Wachowski trilogy of science fiction movies. Mm-hmm. What you think is real is not real, but will tell you what is the real real. Okay, and that's all. No, in Dick's novels, you have 4, 5, sometimes 6 different possibilities. Which is the real one? We don't know.
We should talk a little bit more about his work. Is there another story that you think illustrates pretty well what we're talking about, this ontological uncertainty?
Let me speak about Ubik, which is a 1968 novel. It's set in a far future where big corporations fight against each other using people with supernatural powers, sort of telepaths, telekinesis, and things like this. Psi-power. Well, there is an agency that provides big corporations with people with a special talent. They are called the Inertials. They don't have real psi-powers. They can stop people who have them. So if you are worried that one of your executives' thoughts can be read by a telepath, you put an Inertial near him and stop that. This is just the beginning of the story, because what happens is that there is a bombing, and this group of characters think they have survived, but strange things begin to happen, and they realize that, as a famous sentence says in the novel, they are not alive, they are all dead, and kept in a sort of cryogenic suspension, a sort of half-life, as it is called in the novel. So what they experience is not a real world. It's a sort of a collective hallucination sustained by machines, because their employer wants to keep them alive to ask for advice in the commercial struggle that goes on in the story.
God, that's creepy.
It's quite creepy. It is a classical example of Dick's black humor, and he had a lot of that, actually. And in this story, you see, the basic problem is that since the characters through whose eyes you see the narrative foci of the story are all dead and are in a sort of collective hallucination, what is really going on outside? Who knows?
In a low voice, Pat said, "I don't go back in time." She raised her eyes, confronted Joe Chip half apologetically, half belligerently. "I do something, but Mr. Ashwood has built it up all out of proportion to reality." "I can read your mind," Gigi said to her, looking a little nettled. "I know you can change the past. You've done it." Pat said, "I can change the past, but I don't go into the past. I don't time travel, as you want your tester to think." "How do you change the past?" Joe asked her. "I think about it. One specific aspect of it, such as one incident or something somebody said, or a little thing that happened that I wish hadn't happened. The first time I did this, as a child..." "When she was 6 years old," Gigi broke in. "Living in Detroit with her parents, of course, she broke a ceramic antique statue that her father treasured."
"Didn't your father foresee it?" Joe asked her, "with his precog ability?"
"He foresaw it," Pat answered. "And he punished me the week before I broke the statue. But he said it was inevitable. You know, the precog talent, they can foresee, but they can't change anything."
What happens in the end is that something make you understand, make you realize, make readers realize that what you thought to be the real world outside, where people are still alive and life goes on while those unlucky people in the so-called moratorium are dead, even the apparently real world maybe isn't. So in the end, you really don't know.
Right. And so the end result is you put the book down and you wonder, am I really alive, or am I something somebody else is dreaming, or am I kept in, yes, cryogenic suspension?
Or you read it twice to see if you have missed some important detail that maybe make you understand if there is another possibility.
Is it strange at all, given this kind of twisty, turny, kind of paranoid world that Dick created in his network of novels, is it ever weird to you to think of him as dead? Do you wind up thinking, could somebody as complicated as Philip K. Dick actually be completely dead?
Well...
Do you know what I mean? I mean, of course he is.
Yeah, okay.
But he created this world in which people are so often not really dead.
Yeah, well, there's another science fiction writer, Michael Bishop, who wrote a novel whose title is Philip K. Dick is Dead, Alas. He wrote it in 86 or 87. In that novel, he imagines that Dick doesn't die in 1982, but goes on living in another world, a different world from ours. The novel had been written in 86. At that time, Nixon was still alive, but obviously Reagan was the president of the United States. So Bishop imagines an alternate reality in which Nixon is still the president in 86, because he gets re-elected and re-elected every 4 years. And he's a sort of life president, like those people you have, I don't know, in North Korea. Mm-hmm. Okay, and Dick is alive. And he sort of is a dissident, like those intellectuals in the Soviet Union who were not allowed to express their opinions but had to circulate their writings in an illegal form, mm-hmm. To smuggle them, the so-called the samizdat, you know. Mm-hmm. And Dick, in that novel, he didn't die but survived and in some ways part of the resistance. So you see, the idea that Dick is not really dead but survives in some way has been already exploited by someone. Anyway, my personal opinion is that, well, I'm a literary critic and I don't believe in the survival of the soul after death, but I believe that something survives in literature and something survives in books. And I'm not the only one to think that. Also, John Milton said something about that. A life after life, he called it. And surely, Dick is living a life after his own life in his novels and in his short stories.
in the parallel universe he created himself.
Our universe, which may be a parallel universe. Maybe. Parallel to what, I don't know, but there's a possibility. There's a chance that it's like that.
Umberto, thank you so much for talking today.
You're welcome.
Umberto Rossi is the author of The Twisted Worlds of Philip K. Dick, a reading of 20 ontologically uncertain novels. He spoke with N. Strange Champs. As we just heard, Philip K. Dick was constantly exploring the question of what is reality in his fiction. So we're curious, how would you answer the question, what is reality? You can let us know by sending us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Philip K. Dick was married 5 times. His third wife was Anne Williams Rubinstein. She now goes by the name Anne Dick. They were married for 6 years, from 1959 to 1965, and she's written a book that chronicles their relationship. It's called The Search for Philip K. Dick. Anne Dick tells Steve Paulson about the first time she met Dick in October 1958.
My first husband was a poet, and he had died several weeks before. Here I am living way out in the country. We had been in the city interacting with writers and painters. So I was always interested in people in the arts, and I'd heard this writer had moved to town. So I decided to go down and call on them one afternoon. And so I did. I had to climb their fence because I couldn't make the gate work.
And this was Philip Dick and his wife at the time.
Yes, he was married at the time. He left his wife for me, which I still feel a little guilty about if I think about it. But we had a very intense relationship, so maybe it was okay. But
So what was it like that first time you met him?
You know, I looked at him, and I thought, I've known this person forever. Like, you know, you felt like previous lifetimes, although I don't really believe in previous lifetimes, but that's what it felt like. And he had these gray-green eyes that were rather deeply set in his head, and they sort of like had a light in them, seemed like a flickering light or something, quite brilliant. So that was my first impression. He's a nice-looking man, he was 29 years old then.
And you were 30 at the time.
I was a year and 11 months older. Later on, he'd keep referring to his older wife. Made me so mad.
And you also had 3 young daughters.
Oh, yes, and he just loved my daughters. He was a wonderful father.
Uh-huh.
He played games with them. He made up stories for them. We took them on excursions. We went to the beach. He baked birthday cakes for them. You know, he was just about the perfect husband and perfect father. I mean, if you can imagine the best husband you can imagine, Philip Dick was better than you could imagine.
Wow.
I think it was very stressful for him.
Stressful in what way?
Well, you know, when we were getting divorced, which I never quite understood because he always claimed that I was the great love of his life, he wrote a story after we separated, and it was about this man who was just exhausted, and he goes to meet his wife and children at the airport. Meanwhile, there is like an invasion of proxers who look like human beings who are taking over the earth, some kind of unpleasant aliens. And he gets to the airport, and he sees his wife and children, and he realizes they're proxers. But that's the way he felt, I think. I think he put all this effort into this marriage, and he was just, and his writing, and being a father, and he was just burned out. It wasn't the real him, maybe. I don't know. He's a mystery. You can't figure him out.
Huh. Now, you and Philip Dick were together for 5 years, from 1958 to 64, and this was a very prolific time in his writing career. And it was when he wrote some of his most acclaimed novels, including The Man in the High Castle.
Yes, he did. The books that made him world famous.
So was it just an accident that he had such a productive period, or do you think that had something to do with the two of you being together?
You know, I think it was love. Love is a very creative force. I think that there was a lot of real love between us, despite the fact that he had some problems. And I'm sure I wasn't the easiest wife on earth either.
When you say he had some problems, what do you mean?
Well, like when we'd go on an excursion, he'd unplug all the electric cords, and he'd say, I'm afraid that there'll be a fire, that rats will gnaw them, and we'll have a fire. The house will burn down while we're gone. And then he seemed to think I was going to run over him in the car on one occasion.
Do you think there was any connection between those strange habits and what he wrote about, which was kind of strange in itself?
Oh, I think those books were an autobiography of a strange sort. You know, like a postmodern surrealist autobiography with touches of Jungian dream therapy.
So what do you, I mean, if you don't mind my asking, what caused you to split up with him? Why did he leave?
He left about 17 times and came back and left and came back. He was very tormented. He writes of that period that he was having a psychotic break, but I don't know what that really means. Something was happening to him. I really don't know what it was. That's why I wrote the book, to try to figure out what happened. Hmm. I never did know.
You must have wondered about this all these years. I mean, you sort of didn't know why he left in the end.
No, in fact, one day he was packing his suitcase to leave, and he sat down in the bed heavily, and he said, "You're the great love of my life." And I said, "Well, why are you leaving? Why are you leaving?" And he got up and packed his suitcase and left. I mean, it was very strange. Huh. I have to laugh, because what else can you do but laugh except cry, and I don't feel like doing that.
Well, various people have talked about his inner demons, and, you know, you've just mentioned that, you know, maybe there was something psychotic going on there.
Well, those are just words. You know, I don't believe in those words even.
Uh-huh.
He was a very unusual man, and he was a very great genius, I think. And his circuits weren't wired the same as many other people. But on the other hand, we have a culture of extreme conformity in this country, so maybe he wasn't that far out.
Hmm.
You know, the English cherish their eccentrics.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, I mean, a lot of people have said, oh, you know, Philip K. Dick kind of, you know, descended into madness. It sounds like you're saying that that's been overplayed, that whole narrative.
Oh, I would say so. But I think he liked playing roles, and if somebody around wanted him to descend into madness, he would descend into madness for a while. Try that.
Huh.
Try out that role. But I think he did have some inner problems also.
When was the last time you talked with Philip Dick?
Oh, about a month before he died. You know, he came back over the years, and he phoned me over the years. Not very often, but we weren't exactly in touch because he never really did explain why he left, and I was afraid to ask him for fear he wouldn't call again.
Hmm.
I don't know why. Something like that.
So what did you talk about that last time that the two of you did talk?
Maybe I had a premonition on some level that he wasn't going to live very much longer. And I thought, well, if you don't tell people you love them while they're alive, that's really a shame. So I said, you know, I always love you. And there was just a dead silence. He didn't say anything. And then the next time I talked to him, I guess I talked to him a couple of times in the couple of months before his death, he was telling me all about his new girlfriend, you know, with great vigor.
So did writing the book about him cause you to change the way you've come to think about Philip Dick?
Oh, yes. I don't think you can get into something that involved and do that much research and talk to that many people without your ideas evolving. But I think the basic feeling I have about him is still kicking around somewhere. And I admire him more the more the years go on. The more I see in his writing, I'm not sure I understood it way back then. I enjoyed it. But when you read the entire oeuvre, as they say, you know, in the order in which it was written, it really is quite fantastic. And the stories of the 50s before I even met him are wonderful, too.
Sounds like also you, not only have you come to appreciate his writing more, maybe you, learn to, forgive him is the right word. But...
Yes, I forgive him. I do forgive him.
Uh-huh. What do you think people still don't understand about Philip Dick?
Oh, he is such a complicated man. I think people are very mysterious anyway, and he had more dials and circuits and gears than anybody who ever lived. I think that someone like Philip comes along every 1,000 years or so. He is so unique, so unusual.
Anne Dick is Dick's third wife, and she's the author of The Search for Philip K. Dick. She spoke with Steve Paulson. If you have questions or comments about the show, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, Jonathan Lethem and Hollywood's interpretations of Dickian universes as we continue our hour on Philip K. Dick and his legacy, more than 30 years after his death. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Jonathan Lethem is one of America's most admired literary novelists, a winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award, among others. Not the kind of author you'd expect to champion a sci-fi writer. But Lethem counts Philip K. Dick as one of his literary heroes. So it's only fitting that Lethem is helping to keep Dick's legacy alive through his work as the editor of the Library of America's three-volume box set, the Philip K. Dick Collection. It's a set of 13 of Dick's best science fiction novels, as chosen by Lethem. Dick is the first science fiction writer to be featured in the Library of America series. Jonathan Lethem talks about how Dick viewed his career.
Well, he was a very divided soul about whether or not he had accomplished what he initially set out to do as a writer, because he had very strong ambitions as regards the literary mainstream. He wanted to become legitimate and worked very, very hard and quite hopelessly in the 1950s and early 60s, writing a string of realist novels that went unpublished at the time. And when he finally gave up that attempt and, in a sense, put all of that energy completely into the science fiction, which he thought of as a kind of way to pay the bills or a kind of a slightly embarrassing side career, suddenly the books in the 60s become much, much better, because it's as though he's merged his mainstream ambition with his science fictional imaginative material. And so he becomes very quickly a writer, you know, I think unprecedented in that field or anywhere. Someone with a lot of, I guess you'd say, emotional and psychologically realistic impulses and very strong confessional impulses. I mean, he writes autobiographically again and again and again without it being obvious that he's doing so. But also one of the most extraordinarily weird imaginations ever given to a literary writer. You know, you can look to Kafka or Borges or someone like, I don't know, Kobo Abe or Salman Rushdie. There's really almost no one with as many simply wild ideas and wild images available to them as Dick had.
And he thought about the psychological reasoning that went behind this. One of the things about science fiction in the 50s that seems more true now is that it didn't focus as much on the characters. But Philip Dick really did focus on the characters in his novels and what they were feeling and thinking and how the world affected them.
Well, I think that the form of character that Dick specialized in, truthfully, was almost a helpless symptom of his own personal intensity. He wrote about angry, confused, overwhelmed, sensitive, yearning little men who felt at the mercy of this future that was coming and that he was describing. And he did so because in many ways he was a very turbulent, very sensitive, very helpless individual, and he poured himself onto the page. And so that's the kind of realism that he specialized in.
You've written about this, in fact, in your essay, Crazy Friend.
Yes, I've written about Dick again and again and never felt that I'd completely gotten it right, because he's such an important presence in the constellation of my own influences. I could never stop thinking about him in a way. And in some ways, I'm essay by essay, I'm backing into writing some huge, completely unsatisfying book about Philip K. Dick in all of these attempts. But this is the most recent one.
Well, there's a section of it that I'm hoping you'll read for us, in fact, that is related to what you were just talking about. It's how Dick saw his characters.
Yeah, let me try. Dick tended to give his main characters powerful but unsteady father figures, often resembling Dick's boss, Herb Hollis, at Art Music. This is a shop that Dick worked at when he was briefly employed before becoming a full-time writer. Men both bullying and charismatic, generous and treacherous.
Another version of this archetype recurs in the films of Orson Welles, with the big father, quote-unquote, often played by Welles himself as Falstaff or Kane or Hank Quinlan. I've fooled with this motif myself, most obviously in Motherless Brooklyn's Frank Minna character, but more often have defaulted in my writing to a primary relationship more like siblings or friends, pairs linked by bonds of guilt, yearning, and mutual betrayal. This may be typical of the difference between the post-war boomer generation of which Dick was part, those whose parents were toughened by the Depression and World War II, and my generation, we who experienced the questing, self-revising boomers as our parents. For myself and my friend Jake, there were times when our parents were less like parents and more like crazy friends. As a result, our friendships involved a measure of mutual parenting, or at least, since mutual parenting was really impossible, the impulse to rescue one another from our parents' squishy legacies. And truly, for all my reverence, I never really looked at Philip K. Dick as a literary father, more like a brilliant older brother whose brave and also sometimes half-assed forays charted wild paths for me to follow.
He's an important figure in your life, isn't he? He's part of the reason that you've gone full tilt into writing.
Yes, I first began writing fiction thinking that the only thing to do, the best thing to do, and taking it as my appointment in some way, was to try to carry on his work. I wanted to write books exactly like the ones he didn't live long enough to write, which, of course, is a really odd assignment to give yourself, given that he'd written over 40 of the things and probably wrote every kind of book that he was destined to. But I somehow saw his work as unfinished, and it was going to be my job to carry it on.
Jonathan Lethem is a novelist. He's also the editor of the Library of America's 3-volume box set, the Philip K. Dick Collection. We'll hear from Lethem again at the end of the program. You may not have read any of Philip K. Dick's fiction, but chances are pretty good you've seen at least one film based on his work. Maybe Blade Runner, Total Recall, or The Adjustment Bureau? David Gill's seen them all. Gill is a Philip K. Dick scholar who also runs a website called Total Dickhead. Here's David Gill with his thoughts on Hollywood's adaptations of Dick's work.
Let me start by saying that I'm not sure that Philip K. Dick's writing is particularly well-suited to cinematic adaptation. While everybody loves the science fiction settings and the amazing, incredible ideas, Dick tends to, especially in his short stories, privilege the idea over the character development. And really, those short stories in some cases are 5, 6, 7 pages long, and there's not a full-length movie script there. And so oftentimes what's happened in terms of the short stories is that they take a really nice idea from a short story and then run it through the sausage factory of Hollywood. It ends up kind of this crazy contraption with Tom Cruise as a leading man or Arnold Schwarzenegger, totally miscast. Then they try to graft on a love story, a car chase, and it ends up just overwhelming the gem of the idea that was there to begin with. That's what I would say in regard to the short stories. I think in every case, the 4 times that they've tried to take a Philip K. Dick novel and make a movie out of it, they've been incredibly successful. These would be A Scanner Darkly, Blade Runner, the French film Barjo, and the American independent release Radio Free Albemuth, which is still searching for a distributor.
A new life awaits you in the off-world colonies. The chance to begin again in a golden land of opportunity and adventure.
Blade Runner is absolutely the state-of-the-art in terms of a Dick adaptation. It's probably the best one we have, hands down. Of course, it's not particularly faithful to the original novel, which Ridley Scott never finished. He said, on page 30, I can't make a movie out of this. Many of the important concepts in the novel are cut away. The fake religion of Mercerism, Deckard's wife is eliminated in the movie. And the moral of the story is really inverted. In Blade Runner, you're really talking about how human-like androids can become or may become. And in Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, the moral is very different. It is, in fact, how android-like humans can be. And that's a very different vibe. However, I will say that Blade Runner captures the spirit of the novel better than any other adaptation. The noir landscape, the dark, depressing, dystopian future settings are really the best we have, and they're probably the best depiction of Dick's dystopian future visions.
She's a replicant, isn't she?
I'm impressed. How many questions does it usually take to spot one?
I don't get it, Tyrell.
How many questions?
20, 30 cross-referenced.
It took more than 100 for Rachel, didn't it?
She doesn't know.
She's beginning to suspect, I think.
Suspect? How can it not know what it is?
Commerce is our goal here at Tyrell. More human than human is our motto. Rachel is an experiment, nothing more. We began to recognize in them strange obsession. After all, they are emotionally inexperienced with only a few years in which to store up the experiences which you and I take for granted. If we gift them with the past, we create a cushion or pillow for their emotions, and consequently we can control them better.
Memories. You're talking about memories.
It's kind of one of the most tragic ironies of Dick's life that the movie that was going to make him a household name in some circles, he would never get the chance to see the finished product. He did see some early daily shorts, which showed how Scott was going to depict the future. And Dick was amazed. He asked Ridley Scott, you know, how did you know what I saw in my head? He was incredibly convinced by the settings. And it's unclear how much Dick knew the story had changed. We also know that they did have an altercation at some level about the direction that Scott was taking the movie. But all in all, I think Dick would be happy, especially since Blade Runner really cemented his reputation as a brilliant novelist and a compelling science fiction author. A Scanner Darkly is a very accurate adaptation. Perhaps it's the most faithful adaptation we have, widely distributed. A Scanner Darkly is the story of a narcotics officer who is doing surveillance on a group of burnouts. And what he is loath to discover is that he is in fact surveilling himself, that he is somehow mixed up in the plot that he is trying to police. And so there's a very interesting and somewhat schizophrenic view of a split personality that's really captured quite brilliantly by Keanu Reeves. He does a good job of playing both a sort of clueless cop and an even more clueless burnout.
What does a scanner see? Into the head? Down into the heart? Does it see into me? Into us? Clearly or darkly? I hope it sees clearly, because I can't any longer see into myself. I see only Mark. I hope for everyone's sake the scanners do better. Because if the scanner sees only darkly the way I do, then I'm cursed and cursed again, and will only wind up dead this way, knowing very little. And getting that little fragment wrong, too.
The most significant change that Linklater made was to rotoscope the film, which involved shooting it and then hand illustrating or animating each cell to create a kind of hybrid animation, live action film. And from what I understand, most people who dislike the film find what they don't like about it is the rotoscoping. Let me just talk briefly about a couple of films that I think are great adaptations of Dickian ideas that don't owe themselves directly to Dick's scripts. In other words, films like The Matrix, The Truman Show, 13th Floor, Dark City, Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind. These are all great Dick adaptations that owe very little to a specific Dick script, but rather take their inspiration from Dick's big ideas about identity and reality and the elusive nature of perception itself. So there are a lot of really great movies out there where the borrowing from Dick is done sort of secondhand and a little more generally, and those have been incredibly successful. So again, films like The Matrix and Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind show that Dick's influence will be around even if they're not making movies based on his work. But we live in a society in which people inhabit various realities, and these realities are in some ways separate from each other. In other words, it's possible to watch Fox News and have a completely separate perception of the reality than watching MSNBC. And Dick's work envisioned that 50 years before it was a reality. And so there is always going to be a place in our society, as long as we're fractured and fractionalized and competing for narrative space in our society, we're going to be talking about his books and ideas and his films.
David Gill with his thoughts on movies based on Philip K. Dick's fiction. You'll find a link to Gill's Dick-related website, Total Dickhead, on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, Jonathan Lethem joins us again, this time to talk about Dick's final magnificent work, The Exegesis, as we conclude our hour on Philip K. Dick and his legacy more than 30 years after his death. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Novelist Jonathan Lethem joins us again. This time, he's going to talk about a book called The Exegesis of Philip K. Dick. Lethem co-edited it with Pamela Jackson. The Exegesis is a 900-page doorstop based on the bizarre collection of thousands of pages of typed and handwritten notes, journal entries, letters, and story sketches that Dick obsessed over during the last 8 years of his life. He was trying to come to terms with a series of strange, visionary experiences. Jonathan Lethem tells Steve Paulson about the events that changed Dick's life.
It's so easy to ask and it's so hard to say, because, of course, saying what happened to him is what the whole project of The Exegesis consists of. What we're certain happened is that he began to experience an almost overwhelming sense of revelation. Visions occurred to him and concepts occurred to him. Voices came to him. Dreams that weren't like regular dreams happened to him at night, and he ascribed all of this to some kind of higher power. And he didn't know what it was, but he felt contacted by something, and he began to try to interpret it.
And it goes back originally, apparently, to a visit to the dentist when he had his wisdom teeth removed.
He'd been to the dentist, and he needed a painkiller, and the pharmacist sent a delivery person to his door. And he opened the door, and the delivery person was a young woman who was wearing a Christian fish, you know, that symbol that we see on the backs of bumpers of cars now. And she was wearing it around her neck, and he was struck, not just by curiosity, but he felt some kind of awesome flood of information entering his body and his brain at that moment. And he asked her what it was, and she said it was a symbol of ancient Christianity. So that seemed to be a very important clue. And from that point on, and for the next couple of months especially, although the visions were intermittent for the rest of his life, he was recipient of a flood of unsettling, revelatory feelings and thoughts.
And to the point where, I mean, in this particular case, apparently he thought that he and this young woman who delivered the painkiller were were secret Christians from way back when. I mean, there was sort of this sense of, I don't know if reincarnation is the right word, but there was a long history that went back there.
That was one of the thoughts he had, and he became obsessed with historical interpretations, theological interpretations, philosophical concepts. At one point, he thought he was being taken over by the ghost, essentially, of a dead friend of his, Bishop Pike, who had been a very important figure in the Bay Area religious scene a few years before and had died in mysterious circumstances in the desert in Israel. He believed for a while that this was evidence that the entire universe was a computer, and he generated a lot of notions and theories that actually recapitulate a lot of some of the most far-out speculations of contemporary philosophy and physics. He basically grappled with this revelation with every tool available to him, from Encyclopedia Britannica to going to see Nicholas Roeg's film The Man Who Fell to Earth with David Bowie in it, and suddenly imagining that an alien race had contacted him. He'd use anything at hand, basically, to try to adjust and interpret and expand his guess about what kind of mystical vision he was undergoing.
Now, it would be tempting to write off these episodes as psychotic in some way, or maybe drug-induced, you know, after he originally had his wisdom teeth extracted. I don't know, but that seems too simple.
Well, it's almost impossible not to want to write them off or explain them away in some form. I sort of joke in the introduction that anyone looking for a description other than revelation will be spoiled for choice. You can guess that he was experiencing some kind of series of small strokes. You can guess that he was undergoing a very specific kind of neurological disorder called temporal lobe epilepsy. You can guess about drugs. You can guess about paranoia. You can guess about schizophrenia. You can decide he was just a science fiction writer who'd taken his own visions too seriously. And I think that what's worth saying is that all of these things are theories he himself would have been interested in. And he generates his own guesses about psychosis in the pages of the exegesis. It wasn't that he insisted that there was a divine explanation or that he was somehow suddenly in an exclusive conversation with a higher power. It's that he was experiencing an intricate and extensive series of philosophical thoughts as a result, and he thought it was worth trying to understand them on some term or another. So he himself is very open to some of the exact explanations that others would use to dismiss what was going on. And the reason it's impossible to dismiss the exegesis is not because there could ever be any evidence that something other than one of these explanations was the cause of it. Forget the cause. The pages themselves exist. He wrote in this vein brilliantly for 8 years of his life. They're basically a very brilliant mind going mano a mano with the universe.
I love your description of the exegesis. I mean, you say it's absolutely stultifying, it's brilliant, it's repetitive, it's contradictory, it just might contain the secret of the universe.
Yeah, well, that's a sort of a tease. The problem with looking to it for an answer is not that it doesn't contain one. It's that it doesn't contain one. It contains 1,000. He contradicts himself again and again. He throws everything out and goes back to the drawing board and generates another theory about how time and space and mind interact and why we're here and what the universe consists of. So it's useless as a compass. It won't lead you to anything in the way of a solution to the matter of existence, but it will, if you do give yourself to these pages, it will give you an immense experience of how perplexing, how rich, how extraordinary the dilemma of existence really is.
So do you have favorite passages or parts of the exegesis?
I have loads, yeah. It switches gears a lot. You know, he was a very complicated, contradictory, very seductive and brilliant mind. He was famous for taking people on strange journeys. If they'd come and visit him, he'd tell them what they wanted to hear, and he'd do it for hours on end. He was a Rorschach blot of a mind. The exegesis itself, sometimes it comes on very punitive and moralistic, like a kind of a nightmarish vision of God's requirements, and other times it's very polymorphous and inviting and strange and charming, and there are times when he despairs of ever understanding what his purpose on earth might be, and there are times when he becomes quite fascinated with his own writing, and he decides the answer might lie in his earlier novel. So if you're interested in his writing, you can find pages upon pages of him deciding all of a sudden that a book he wrote in 1964 is the answer to everything, that he accidentally already knew how everything worked in Ubik or The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch. I like a lot of it, and I like a lot of it in different ways. There are times, not a great number of them, where he switches into his storytelling mode, and he starts to be the writer you're familiar with from his novels, writing brilliant allegories or brief fables, essentially.
You have a copy of the exegesis of Philip K. Dick there with you, and I guess I'm going to ask you to pick out something, and you have 900 pages to choose from, but a short passage that you'd like to share with us?
Okay, this is a nice bit to read. So in this sequence, he's talking about one of the most important names he's given to the spirit that seems to be reaching out to him from afar, from across history or from another dimension. And he's called it Zebra. And he's named it Zebra for its capacity to hide itself within our reality, for the stripes on its body that mean that unless you're looking very closely, it becomes invisible and just is taken as a natural part of our universe. But in fact, it's an enormously energetic spirit from afar.
Okay.
Paul Williams visited today, and I told him about Zebra. I'm beginning to see in my mind's eye Zebra itself, an actual animal, a striped horse. Shy and merry and mischievous, half hiding in the forest at the far edge, the sun shining, and Zebra playfully advancing, and then just when you think he's going to emerge fully and separate himself from the trees, suddenly and unexpectedly he retreats and absolutely vanishes. You can't coax him out or lure him. You can't get your hands on him. His white is the dazzle of the sun, his dark stripe the shadows in the glade and forest, where amid the shadowy green the little things of the forest live unseen. Ah, Zebra, why really did I choose that name for you? You mythical lovely beast of sun and safe shadow, I saw you once but can never, as if you are some fabled deity, prove to anyone that you exist. I inform them, I try to take you along with me to the special spot from which I saw you, and you're not there. But I sense the glint in your eye and your smile of understanding amusement. Are you the joy god Dionysus of root and star, of dark forest and the melting butter gold of the sun? What a psychological symbol Jung would have known you to be, playful and unpredictable, shy, pawing the ground with sharp hooves, goat hooves. Oh, goat god Dionysus, I recognize you. You are too wise, too experienced with our dangerous race ever to expose yourself to harm at our hands. We would kill and freeze you into stasis, hypostasis, and all your pawing and advancing and disappearing and smile, light would become dead glass, warm butter only hide, dead, frozen. But this is only your exoskeleton. Inside this form which I glimpse, you are motion and rapid change. Electrons? Sheer bioplasmic energy? I love you, I want to grip you, but you are elusive. But I am not disappointed. You are all the lovely passing persons, things and events I would want to freeze, to stop dead. Thank God I can't, Zebra. My clutching, hugging, yearning embrace would kill you. My needs kill. My fingers are the claws of the petrified dead, yearning to hold your life. Better this petrified fossil that I am should stay dead, that so you can live on in immortality. Thank you. Thank you for hiding from me. Thank you for your wise caution and your secret smile.
Jonathan Leatham, reading from The Exegesis of Philip K. Dick. Leatham is the co-editor, along with Pamela Jackson, of the book. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling a radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Philip K. Dick. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Special thanks to special guest engineer Aubrey Ralph. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.